Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel. I am your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am here today with Bertin Martens, my Bruegel colleague and fellow senior fellow, and Kai Zenner from the office of Axel Voss in the European Parliament. We are going to talk to you about the universe of European Union digital regulation. There are so many laws and rules out there, and they are put together often in ways where it's hard from the outside to see how they go together or if they go together. We are very lucky to have Kai with us today because he has helped Bruegel put together a data set of all the different EU tech laws that there are. You should go on our website and find this. It is a thing of wonder. So, Kai, how did you put this together? Can you tell our listeners just how many of these things there are?
Yes. So first of all, many thanks for the invitation. And indeed, at the moment, there are 170 digital laws from the European Union. Also connected to that, there are 76 digital governance or enforcement bodies, networks, and so on. And the history behind this is basically that I called DigiConnect one day and asked them for an overview, because me as an advisor, assistant in the European Parliament, really struggled to make sense how everything is connected. And DigiConnect told me, well, we don't have that. And then I checked a little bit with the EPRS and found that Scott Marcus, your colleague, did something limited on that. And I basically took that as a basis and was then extending it. And after a few months, Scott joined the project, and now we are continuing to update it and so on.
So it's the European Parliament Research Service.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the effort that we have to keep track of what's going on. Bertin and I have done podcasts before, and Bertin has written a lot about the different EU digital laws, and it usually boils down to the Digital Markets Act, which listeners will remember is the gatekeeper's one. It's the big one about opening up your system, for example, the iPhone App Store to other competitors. And then the Digital Services Act. This is the one about consumer protection and fraudulent listings and things like that. And then you have the Artificial Intelligence Act on AI. Before that, there was also something called the Data Act, which Bertin knows much more about than I ever have and possibly ever will. And beyond those four, I get lost. Are there others that are equally important? Are those the main ones, Kai?
Well, you can definitely argue that those four are the main ones for this legislative term.
Right, we had the General Data Protection Regulation, of course,
exactly.
Also.
Before, there were a lot of others, but then, for example, there is NIS2, there is the Cybersecurity Act, also from last term, which was huge and with the certification has produced a lot of work for companies and so on. And then, let's say every sector or every direction has a few super important laws, like also Product Liability Directive. Is coming from 1985, was now updated. Now software is included. So certainly it's important for every digital company. And I think this is why our overview is so handy to a lot of people, because maybe there are a few big digital laws that everyone knows. The four that you mentioned, GDPR, again, Cybersecurity Act probably, and a few others, but there is much more. And depending on what you are doing as company, but also depending on what research you are doing as academics, university, other digital laws are maybe similarly important, maybe even more.
So the last concept I would like to introduce to our listeners is the one of better regulation. This is a fairly new explicit commission goal, and the idea is that there won't be as many overlapping regulations and there won't just be piles upon piles. It's hard to see that in action here. How would you say, has that even been a factor at all?
Good question. I would argue that the last commission under Commission President Juncker and Martin Selmayr as his right hand, better regulation, of course, didn't work perfectly fine in all instances. For example, my boss and I, we didn't like the whistleblower directive or the collective redress directive very much. We would say they didn't follow better regulation principles, but the vast majority definitely. This term, I think it was the opposite, because the Commission became even more political, and let's say all those safeguards that the better regulation framework has installed over the last, let's say, 10 years, they were kind of disabled, overlooked, not used, and so on. And this leads to a really strange situation. The European Union is still ranked on place number one in the OECD better regulation ranking because, again, we have every safeguard and every mechanism that is needed installed and there, but they are disabled, overlooked, not used. And this is more a problem. So that we should really go back to our origins, to the last term proceedings, and do things like a proper impact assessment. Let the regulatory scrutiny board do their job and so on. And then I think we would also have a much more coherent framework of those 117 digital laws that we were discussing. Right now, it's not really coherent.
Bertin, you have contributed so much to Bruegel to make sense of these laws as they've come into place. Do you think they fit together?
Good question also. My experience is that there are lots of overlaps, lots of contradictions, lots of incoherences, semantic distortions and confusion, every possible problem you can think of. Especially, well, since I'm dealing with data regulation and platform regulation in particular, I see these many different pieces and try to make sense of how they fit together, and it's really very difficult. I agree with Guy that over the last couple of years, I think we see a sort of degradation of the use of these better regulation guidelines. The last set of better regulation guidelines dates back to 2023, so fairly recent. And there are good guidelines, but they are not followed or they are not used. We see that the regulatory scrutiny board is not always doing its job of sending back a poorly done impact assessment. Of course, the regulatory scrutiny board is an internal structure within the commission, and these people get under lots of pressure when there are really important pieces of regulation, so their margin for maneuver is limited. My idea would be, but I'm open to suggestion, would like to hear what Guy thinks about this. My idea would be that for the next commission, the commission would have to set up a possibility for an external assessment of these internal impact assessment, and not done by commercial consultants who regularly work for the commission under framework contracts and then will be careful in what they say in their assessment because they want to have the next contract, but by really independent people who really know the subject area very well. So I think that would be a good way to go forward. Kai, what do you think about this?
Yeah, so this is actually something many political groups in the European Parliament also mention quite regularly in position papers, in our own initiative reports. We are also commenting better regulation communications like the one in 2023 from the Commission as a legal committee in the Parliament. And again, this point we always underlined, similar to most Brussels-based think tanks, that it doesn't make any sense to do the supervision only internally in the European Commission because, as you said, if the Commission wants to do, for example, a certain digital law, sustainability law, and then there is a problem in it, then of course there is a strong push to ignore those problems and just bring it through. And we saw one thing that you and I didn't mention so far, this big problem of time pressure that came in this term. And I think it's not only going back to certain structural problems in the European Commission, but really to COVID, because COVID kind of took us, let's say, 2 years of potential policymaking, and then we had only a very short period of time to implement, discuss all of our ideas that we had. And then, of course, I think many, many occasions are publicly known where there were problems in the impact assessments, there were problems in the proposal of the European Commission, but then there was a strong argument from some commissioners, no, too important, we need to present it now, so let's just hope that those mistakes will not be known, not be seen, or we can solve them during the process. But this, of course, is also always rather difficult. To back to your question, definitely an external supervision would be extremely helpful. And what you are saying is crucial, that if we are having this external body or mechanism, then of course we would need to make really sure that it's impartial, so that they are not depending on new contracts from the Commission, or that certain stakeholders, no matter if civil society or companies, are having a big role within this mechanism and can also pressure, because then it's just a different kind of pressure.
Yeah. I'm actually wondering, with these impact assessments, having been there myself before in my previous life before Bruegel, to what extent does the Commission have an interest in really doing an independent assessment? There is this theory among political scientists that policymaking is partially a question of facts and negotiation over objectively verifiable data and so on, but to a large extent also persuasion and trying to find the right words and coalitions to get what you want to get. And so impact assessments, in my experience, are often that the Commission just takes the evidence that suits its purpose, but quietly drops, and sometimes not so quietly, silences the people who want to come with other type of evidence that maybe contradicts its policy objectives. So how can we deal with that? One way would be to have these external independent experts looking at it, but even external independent experts have to come sometimes their own views. So how do you do that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I would now actually present a little bit a vision that I have to implement. And because, as you said, it's really true. And I saw it in a lot of impact assessments that they were written, like we are saying in Germany, from the result, basically. So you knew there are five policy options, but it's always the one in the middle. And basically, everyone knows at the beginning already that it will be this one. Of course, this is something normally I think should not happen. And an alternative would be really to split the policy cycle a little bit. So what we could do, like, for example, in artificial intelligence, we had a lot of expert groups, the high-level expert group, but also internationally, a lot of prep work. Then this prep work was being put together, and again, the Commission chose to do a horizontal AI act without ever consulting with the member states or with the European Parliament if this is our preferred option. In my perfect world, we would now basically do the following in the next term: to split the legislative process, have this prep work, then we have already first trialogue between member states and parliamentarians, where we are deciding for one policy option, and then the Commission is basically making a proposal based on this legislative choice from the co-legislators. But my problem is really what we saw in the past, that it was only the Commission that is making this policy choice, and we as co-legislators do not have any possibility to change the choice again. But I don't know if this is really possible to execute and implement.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the role of the institutions. Welcome back. Berendsen, how does this work in practice?
Yeah, I was just thinking about Guy's proposal. Doesn't that upset them a little bit, the role of the different institutions? Because the commission is the one that normally makes proposals, and then it's up to the council and the parliament to say yes or no, or to modify it in the trialogue and so on. Also, in your proposal, if I understand you correctly, parliament and council would sit together and say, this is what we want. And then it's the commission up to the commission to do the studies, the impact assessment. But that would sort of reverse engineer the policy outcome that the parliament wants. Isn't that... I'm not comfortable with this approach as an economist. I would say you first have to analyze the problem and the question and then look at possible solutions.
This is where I interject with our institutional histories. Bertin spent a long time working for the European Commission, most recently in the Joint Research Center before leaving for a life of ideas here at Bruegel and elsewhere. Kai, of course, is still working in the European Parliament. His member that he works with is part of the European People's Party, which is the majority party and therefore the agenda-setting party that works most closely with the Parliament President and with the Commission President, also currently from the EPP group. I have never had a full-time job in the institution, but I have been a contractor for both the Parliament and the Commission, mostly doing reports and editing work and being an expert at times in Parliament hearings. So we all have a history of working with the institutions in our ways. I have worked with member states through my work writing a book about the European Stability Mechanism, which is entirely run by the member states who make up the Council. This is the third of the co-legislators, as we call them in policy jargon. What we see in Brussels, for those of you joining us from perhaps outside the EU, is that each of these agencies or constituencies has their own culture. The Commission really works hard to get the logic right. The Commission has the right of initiative to start the lawmaking process, as Bertin said. And people there are very thoughtful about what they're doing. It really is policy motivated. It is being a technocrat, I often feel, in the most constructive sense, trying to come up with what would be best for the most citizens across the 27-country EU. The member states are representing the democratically elected governments of all of these places. They are their delegated representatives in Brussels, and sometimes the leaders themselves come to Brussels. And so they represent a lot of democratic pushback for these things because they think, how will this play for our national parliament at home? Then the European Parliament. And Kai, I'm coming to you to say, how does the European Parliament, with its rising role, particularly on technical files, the Parliament now has more say over technical files than it's ever had. It has more expertise than it's ever had because people like you are now coming to work in it now that there's, with the different treaty changes, you guys can do this. So from the Parliament's perspective, how has that grown over this term? How might that look in the new Parliament, which we are now widely expecting to be more volatile than the current one?
I think your observation is completely true, and probably we will see an even more vocal parliament. Going back again to the AI Act, we were extremely convinced about our approach that we worked on in the AIDA Special Committee on AI that was taking place before the AI Act has been presented. We had a strong majority for other own initiative reports on AI ethics, on AI liability, and so on. The Commission didn't really follow our ideas, which already created a lot of problems. And you saw in the political process, as you said, that the Parliament was rather comfortable table in putting out completely new proposals and concepts. And there, going back to our previous discussion, I definitely don't want to change the whole legislative process. But I think right now, and also to your point, with such a confident, self-confident parliament, the old procedure where basically what happens in this drafting the first proposal by the Commission completely alone is not really working anymore. There, the other two co-legislators should be more involved in order to make this conceptual choice for one of the directions. And there, if we have there a kind of majority line, then we can really focus on how to make it better. But yeah, my feeling is a little bit the European Parliament will be more and more pointing to our own initiative reports, to our ideas, and less accepting if the Commission is not really concretely following up on it. And of course, this probably, let's use the word annoys a little bit then also the member states that are not always interested in a very vocal and strong European Parliament. So, yeah, maybe we will see a little bit stronger competition between those three actors that we were now talking about. But again, my solution would be, or one of the solutions would be, to just involve all three constantly in the whole process and basically trying to build a common line as early as possible. But of course, still do all the research as it is necessary. And as Bertin and I were saying, involve also external actors to do a review of impact assessment and so on.
So as regular listeners will know, when the Commission makes a proposal, the first thing that happens is the member states agree on what's called a general approach to start negotiations. The Parliament also does that. And then you have three different starting points: the Commission's original proposal, and then the Council's rewrite of it, and the Parliament's rewrite of it. And that then goes into something that is so elegantly called a trilogue, because there are three people in it. And those can go on for a long time. They can go on. The AI Act one was famous for going on, 48 hours at the end? Even more.
36 hours, basically, really in-depth discussions, but it was basically a break of 12 hours between or something. Yeah.
I get tired just thinking about what that was like. So you have these trilogues, and then after that, it has to go back to the Council, which is the member states again, and also the Parliament for final votes. So there are a lot of stages where people have to weigh in. This happens for every one of those 117 laws, which can come in the form of a directive, which tells national countries how to rewrite their own rules to agree with the EU standards, and or you can have one or both of a regulation where it says everybody has to do it this way. And this is just to get the rules done before they have to go out and be disseminated. Bertin, in your various research lives, you have really had a bird's eye view of what happens when these are put in practice. And I would love you to pull a couple examples, maybe the Data Act compared with some of the regulations that have come afterwards, to just say, once we get through all of this, can you do both of these things at the same time?
First of all, I think the Commission's position is usually to make sure that its proposals get enacted by Parliament and Council. But then afterwards, the implementation is usually largely left to member states and their administrations. But there are cases where the Commission itself is in charge. And for instance, with the Digital Markets Act, we have that now, where the Commission is leading it, while member states also to some extent play a role, but the Commission is in the lead. You also have other acts like GDPR, where you have a data supervisory authority that plays an important role and so on. So there are various ways of enacting this. But coming back to your question, how do you implement this when you get this bunch of, say, digital regulations falling on a company's head and they have to implement it? And when you see it's not very coherent between all these legislations and regulations, this is a problem. And talking to companies that have to implement these things and talking to companies that advise other companies in the implementation of these things, we see that this is very difficult sometimes and very costly also. With the AI Act, for example, companies that developed AI models get a lot of compliance requirements now, and they're costly for them to implement. And for small startups, for example, this may be very, very difficult to do. So yes, all in all, this can be very difficult to do.
Can you think of any EU regulations that are in almost explicit conflict with each other?
Yes. For instance, for the moment, I'm working on the Data Act and the GDPR and the Digital Markets Act and related data regulations. And I see, for example, that the question of which data a user can access is not coherent across all these regulations. We have one, I think, beautiful example in the area of data regulation, which is the European health data space that was very recently finally approved. And for me, this is a sort of perfect data regulation because it allows people to port their data between hospitals and medical doctors. It enables pooling of health data so that researchers can do research on that. It's very good for innovation. I said, why don't we use that model as a general model all over the place for data regulation? But no, then we get the Data Act that does something very different, makes it even difficult for users to access their data because the machine producer that generates the data has his own rights to these data and can restrict access and can ask for payment to get access to the data. So all that is not very coherent.
Is there any reconciliation process after the fact?
No, and I think just to complement what Bertin was saying, I'm coming later to the basically what is happening after the implementation or application of the law. It really starts that, and we see it in the European Parliament nonstop, and I will now use the AI Act as kind of example, that there's a proposal where a unit with very highly qualified, as you said, commission officials was working on a long time. But then, as Bertin and I were saying, unfortunately, for example, the inter-service consultation in the commission is right now not really working well. On the AI Act, we saw already when it was presented a lot of overlaps, contradictions with the GDPR, with the DSA, with the Platform Work Directive, with NIS2, and so on and so on. Why? Because it's basically isolated work streams that are producing those laws. And to be fair to those people who are writing it, they are under so much time pressure to deliver and so on that it's often not even possible for them to do all this outreach. Secondly, we are living in a, it's a cliche, but I think it's true, in a more complicated world. And therefore, we don't have this luxury anymore that we had maybe in the last century, that there is really one law that is only for agriculture. Nowadays, like with the Data Act, like with the AI Act, it's a horizontal topic where basically you would need to talk with every unit in DG Connect, but also with every directorat in the whole commission. And they are often failing. And this then, in the end, is leading to all those overlaps, also to definitions. Bertin knows it. In data and AI, we have this issue that things like user, for example, are differently interpreted and defined. Unfortunately, it's not only a commission problem, but we in the parliament and also in the council have the same. It's often one committee in the parliament that is doing it, one rapporteur. And even if there is a similar file in the same committee, those two rapporteurs or people that are working on the two files don't have really any, reason to talk as much with each other. If it's in different committees, there's often really no interaction. And in the council, with all the different working groups, with Coreper 1, Coreper 2, there's also almost no cooperation. So if we want to solve it, we need, maybe AI actually can help, we need to identify all those potential overlaps and really force the people to talk to each other, to check through, is now what we are using in the Data Act really usable for open finance, for example, regulation, a data space, or European health data space? Is it really working with the GDPR? So far, no one was doing it. But what I personally hear a lot from the commission is that there is a plan in the next commission to really focus more on implementation. And this is now going to your question, that now we cannot change it anymore in the laws, but basically that now we are taking a little bit of time in 2024, 2025, 2026 to make the system a little bit more coherent and to think about what we are doing if there is a conflict between law number one and law number two, streamlining definition, etc. So I think hopefully we will see a lot of guidelines that are there to clarify all those problems that we have now touched upon.
It's so good that you mentioned definitions, because that is a regular complaint with all of these new things, is what do each of these terms specifically mean, and are they defined the same way? How do you think that's going, Bertin?
I like it when Kai says the next commission should more focus on implementation. But, Kai, you know very well that, for example, in the AI Act, there are dozens of implementation guidelines and definitions and what have you, that are still to be defined. And there is a lot of leeway and margin for maneuver there. And so the question is, to what extent will the Parliament have supervision powers over all these guidelines and implementation directives? And probably the Commission will not do impact assessments on those, although they will have an impact, and depending on how you design this. So how can we streamline that process as well? How can we do that? Do we have institutional mechanisms? I don't see them so readily available, but maybe you have a better idea.
So you're completely right. There are actually only delegated acts, as you know, where we as Parliament and the Council need to say yes or no. Implementing acts, guidelines, but also the whole area of technical harmonized standards are not really supervised or approved by the co-legislators, which is kind of at odds with our principle of democracy. On the other hand, this was a really clear policy choice from the Commission, from Member States, and from the European Parliament, also to address a regular criticism coming from industry that our laws are basically always outdated as soon as they are becoming applicable. So, I think there is not a perfect solution, but we found, without using this more dynamic and flexible policy tool, such as harmonized technical standards, guidelines, and so on, we will always be behind the technical advance, and basically this is our only chance to catch up. However, you are right, we should probably think about how we can bring the representatives of the citizens back in the game. So maybe as long as there are no institutionalized mechanisms, we just hope that we, for example, our bosses as parliamentarians, can then go to the Commission, have talks, write an article, tweet something, or write something in LinkedIn if they are seeing that some guidelines are going in a completely different direction, and the Commission is then listening to what we are saying. So this is at the moment the hope, how to force guidelines and co to go in the right direction. But you are right, probably more is needed, how we bring back the principle of democracy for those new policy tools.
When we come back, I'd like to talk more about the role of the courts in all of this. Kai, you have a legal background. How do the courts fit in at the European level and at the national level?
Again, using now the AI Act, I think the courts will play a huge role, because the law is so vague that we produced. Again, it's heavily built up on secondary legislation. And Bertin made the point that sometimes maybe the Commission doesn't want to do it. In most cases, I would argue they are just overwhelmed with tasks. The poor AI office, which at the moment has not a lot of people, needs to do a huge list, Bertin is right on that, of different things. So probably they will not be able to do so in time. For example, there should be guidelines out how to understand the prohibitions in Article 5. They are already becoming applicable in December of this year. So actually, companies have a few months now to adjust to something that is not clear what will happen. Probably that most AI developers, if they are really getting a fine or other enforcement actions going against them, will go in front of a court and say, okay, look, no one understands what this law is saying, and help us, because we don't think that this was a lawful reaction from the commission or some national enforcement body. And again, also going back to our 117 digital laws overview, I think many companies will also see a situation, Bertin also mentioned it, where maybe one law is saying you need to do that. For example, you need to secure privacy of the consumers. But then another law is saying you need to make sure that there are not discriminatory decisions. But sometimes you need then private or personal data in order to fight against discrimination. So maybe there are more and more situations now with all those laws where companies cannot do it right. They will always violate an obligation. And this probably will be solved by courts again on the European level and on the national level, especially for those, for this period that we probably need to make sense of all those new additions via new digital laws and build up a coherent digital ecosystems, basically.
Yeah, and this role of the courts is a very interesting issue. I'm just an economist, but I think lawyers could debate endlessly over the pros and cons or the advantages and disadvantages of a common law system where the courts play a very important role, and our continental European system where it's the legislator that says this is what needs to be done. And I see this, for instance, in copyright, also part of the AI Act, actually, where you see the pressure building up. Well, the AI Act leaves some things vague and undefined in terms of copyright. And you see pressure building up in courts, where companies go to courts and saying, we want a court judgment on this or that, on our rights, for instance, in copyright. And there's a risk that the courts take a decision, set a precedent, and then it will become very difficult for the legislators to go against this. We see this also in the Digital Markets Act, where the Commission implements, and if a company disagrees, well, it immediately has to go to the European Court of Justice to complain about the Commission. And so the European Court of Justice will become an important player in how this the implementation of the Digital Market Act actually rolls out and what impact it will have. So this leaves a lot of space for debate and discussion. And, well, courts are not democratic institutions. It's the judge that decides.
Is it worth drawing a distinction, I ask both of you, between situations where the law is clear and the companies just don't want to do it and they challenge it on procedural or other grounds versus situations where the law is unclear or in conflict with itself?
I would argue yes, and my big hope is that it's not coming to court cases in the latter case, that enforcement bodies and again, the Commission, also on the AI Act, is it in some cases, sometimes the national competent authorities, that both of them are a little bit less energetic or, let's say, strong in enforcing over the next months until we are solving all those problems and unclarities. Because how should companies, but also universities, be compliant with a paragraph in the DSA or in the AI Act that no one really understands to a certain extent, where we don't have a joint opinion or common approach on. This would be one of the solutions to not get all those problems. Otherwise, yes, we will see some companies to go against certain decisions because they just don't want to follow the law or they disagree with it, but we will see a lot of cases that are basically going back to a situation where a company cannot fulfill the law and no one actually knows how to do it.
I'm not so sure how we are going to solve all these issues. I think the Commission will have to work faster on a number of issues, especially, for instance, in the case of the AI office. But as we know, it's understaffed for the time being, so it's going to be difficult to catch up with that. It will simply create a lot of legal uncertainty for an extended period of time, I'm afraid.
We are coming to the end of this podcast as we close out. Any closing thoughts, Bertin, on what you would like ordinary people to take away from this and how we can make the system better going forward?
I think the message is twofold. One is we are working hard on this. And I'm glad to hear from Kai that the European Parliament is also thinking very hard about these issues. The other thing is, yes, regulation is complex, difficult, hard to find the good middle-of-the-road solution often in many cases. But do not despair. We are working on it.
Yeah, from my side, I would really underline that we should go back to better regulation principles. We have everything in place. We just need to basically stick to those procedures, use those safeguards, and so on. Secondly, I really hope that in the next years, of course, there are always certain things that need to be decided right away, like the COVID vaccines, like there is a war, or a terrorist attack, and so on. But for many laws, for the vast majority of laws, it doesn't really make a huge difference if the law is being applicable in June of the year or in August or in September. I would really like to see the next commission, the next parliament, and the next council in those situations to say, okay, no, we are not sure, especially in technical legislation, about what does this mean for practitioners and so on. Let's reach out to people that know more about it. Let's take our time to the point that Bertin was making on foundation model generative AI. Even though I was pushing very much for regulating it, I'm feeling very uncomfortable with the current version because there was no impact assessment. There was a complete rush through in these discussions. We even as co-legislators didn't really reflect on it. Those things should really not appear again. And yeah, again, we should just take then in those instances more time and also be a little bit humble as legislators, especially on those technical topics, not thinking that we know all the answers, but engaging again more directly with experts from the outside. And this is the last point, I think always very important is to make the whole process of policy making more transparent, because many people that would like to be more engaged do not really understand it, when it's a good timing to engage, when now, for example, as a company, when and to whom you should present a use case that you think should not be regulated in the future, or a scenario that you find dangerous that is so far not on the radar of the policymakers. Those actors should have it more easier to engage and should have a better understanding of the whole process. And I think if we can address those three things, we will heavily or significantly improve the policymaking in the European Union.
Thank you so much for coming on our podcast today, Bertin. Thank you also. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow at Bruegel and columnist for Reuters Breaking Views, joined by Bruegel senior fellow Bertin Martens and Kai Zenner, head of office for Axel Voss in the European Parliament. You can find Kai's wonderful data set that he did in collaboration with Bruegel researchers on our website, Bruegel.org, as well as Bertin's and other colleagues' research papers and all of these, many of these individual acts, maybe not all 117 of them. And we hope you will join us next time on The Sound of Economics, which you can find on all of your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for listening.